Wise Whitehead. That conversation with Dr. Bell really set us up to talk about race and why it's so difficult. The challenges of talking about race. In this hour, I want to get into why is it so difficult to talk about race. I have a guest who's going to join me, but before she does, let me let you know that coming out of that conversation, I want to talk about the fact that America does not love its children. We do not. And I've got proof of why we don't. I have hardcore data to prove to you that this country that talks about children, talks about loving children, we do not love our children. And I want to talk to you about how we can change it. We'll cover all of that in this hour, along with your phone calls at 410-319-8888. Why is it so hard to talk about race? I have Dr. Bedelia Richards on. She's a founder of Race Talk LLC. And she's an associate professor of sociology at the University of Richmond in Richmond, Virginia. Her work with Race Talk gives workshops around the organic synergy between her passion for racial justice, her scholarly interests and expertise, and her years of testing and perfecting innovative and anti-racist pedagogical strategies in the classroom. Dr. Richards, how are you?
I'm doing well, Dr. Kay.
Good. I'm glad that you have joined us. You know, after we came out of listening to Dr. Bell out of Texas, talking about his role and the work that he's done to do transformative civil rights activist justice work and how it's constantly being met by a stone wall, gave me pause to think about why can't we get into these conversations around race? So can you kind of begin by telling us why is it so difficult, not for Black folks to talk about race, but for Black folks to engage folks from other communities who are not of color to have this conversation?
Well, Dr. K, one of the things that I do say to my students when I'm having this conversation is that Black people don't have a problem talking about race and racism, right? That this is a white people problem, right? Now, we may not talk about it in front of white people because we may be afraid of the backlash, but it isn't really a Black people problem. Right? But to get a kind of, at a societal level, what are the barriers to engaging in conversations about race and racism? And I'll say specifically for white people, because that really, these are the folks who really have a problem having these conversations. We can think about the way in which American society is so segregated by race. And so that really insulates white folks from having a kind of authentic cross-racial interactions with people of color, right, across racial lines. It also limits their knowledge of kind of racialized minorities. And so that's, for me, at the macro level, because at societal level, one of the barriers to engaging in these conversations. I mean, I have students coming to my classroom who feel like I've never had to have these conversations before, right? And another kind of thinking about societal level as well, as a sociologist, one of the things that we do talk about is this kind of prevalence of colorblind ideology, right? So before the civil rights movement, it was perfectly fine for, white people to express racist sentiments openly, and that was accepted, right? And then the kind of post-civil rights movement, where it's societally no longer acceptable to do so, colorblind ideology kind of emerged in a sense of like a way of rationalizing, like, okay, so everything is fine now, right? Racism is behind us, and so the best way for us to proceed is just to be colorblind, is to treat everybody the same, right? And you can see that kind of ideology manifests in, students kind of showing up in classrooms thinking, if they even notice racial differences, that is being racist, right? And that is also kind of a barrier. And no one wants, as you know, white person wants to be perceived as racist. So that's also kind of societal level barrier. Mm. Another thing that I would say, though, that's really strong barrier for white people,
right,
are the emotions.
Right. Are you talking specifically about what? The feelings of guilt, the anger, the frustration? Like, what type of emotions are you talking about that people who are not of color tend to have when this conversation comes back on the table? We should keep coming back until we get it changed.
So when I have these conversations with white folks, especially white students, I ask, well, why is it so hard? And one, because of this also, I didn't mention kind of political correctness as another kind of societal of a barrier, but that also is a barrier because there's a thing within American society that you're supposed to be polite, you're not supposed to talk about politics or race, in polite company. And so for many white people, having conversations about race is one of those things that may cause tension. Right? Having conversations about race and racism might reveal them as a racist. And listen, even Donald Trump doesn't want to be called a racist. Okay, so that's how much, that has become like this kind of real insult for white people, right? The sense of guilt, right? So there are all of these emotions that surface for a lot of white folks that are very uncomfortable emotions. That's about how they want to be perceived or not be perceived as not a bad person. And those are all challenges to engaging in conversations, especially cross-racial conversations about race and racism, because they don't want to have, right, to be revealed publicly right. as a racist and as a bad person.
So then how do we move beyond that? So we know that's the reality, that it's difficult to have these conversations. So with that in mind, how do we have them? How do we open up with people who are not of color and have the conversation about race?
I think it depends on who the we are, and since white people have the problem, we'll start there.
Okay.
Right? And I can tell you how I do it in the classroom. Right? Because this is something as a black woman teaching about issues of race and racism in the classroom at a predominantly white institution has been a real challenge for me, right? When I first started teaching. And you could literally kind of feel the resistance in the classroom and the tension in the classroom, and the kind of the silence, like the wall of silence, when I would try to have these conversations. And I had this kind of incident that happened in one of my classes that led to me starting to think about what can I do with my students? Because we can't go anywhere. Like I can't actually teach them the material, the content until I address, this is one of the things I learned, until I address these, these emotions. And so I actually started, created what I now call my Race Talk as a Skill workshop. In one of my classrooms to address, a particular incident that happened where students were just silent and not talking. And then I started kind of testing and doing this in my other courses, my introduction to sociology courses, and kind of experimenting a bit. And I found that work, what I call workshop, has been really successful in really breaking down the barriers. And it's been successful in part, because I do directly address the emotions that students have, interrogate it. I kind of reframe what it means to have these conversations. And I really create what I tell them, what I want to create is a brave space in my classroom. I also normalize the discomfort that students feel, right? And that's perfectly normal. But then I reframe what that discomfort means and ask them to kind of lean into it. I think that having, doing that workshop at the beginning of the semester for me and then kind of revisiting some of those general concepts throughout the semester has really helped a lot. And kind of developing certain strategies when there's silence right. has also really right. helped a lot for me.
Okay, so now, in terms of pulling students out, I'm wondering though, so often mm-hmm. when we hear racist comments, it is hard to jump into the fray, to challenge mm-hmm. people on their beliefs and on the statements that they're saying. What are some strategies that people can use if you hear people saying things? And I'm not talking just randomly in the grocery store, which is mm-hmm. really not a safe thing to do. But what if they're in your environment, in your family, in the classroom with you? Like, what happens then?
So I thought more about in the classroom because that's where I have kind of much of the experience. And for me, actually, the first day of class, I actually address this with my students. There are a lot of things that I do to frame this semester. And one of the things I talk about with my students in the beginning And I use this kind of language of professionalism, though I know that that could be weaponized in many ways. But I use it, and I ask my students, okay, so how can we, what does it mean to be to behave professionally in the context of the classroom? And inevitably, some what comes up, especially because it's a sociology class, is how do we engage in conversations? So, you know, if it doesn't come up, then I explicitly ask, well, what if someone says something offensive? Then what do we do? How do we address that? So for me, one of the things that's helpful is that from the very beginning in my classrooms, I'm already talking about this is going to happen because these are the issues we're going to talk about in this class, right? And this is how should we, and I can do it more as a question and have the students unfold so that I'm not just directing at them, this is what you should do. But I ask them, how should we? Should we just ignore it? Should we? And then I'll ask, if you're the one who says something offensive, how would you like, you know, us to respond? And so for the context of the classroom, it's addressing it and addressing the expectations up front. And so that means that throughout the semester, when this happens, for example, if someone says something offensive and we make it clear, or the other students make it clear that that thing is offensive, we've already had a conversation about how to do it. We do that at the beginning of the class as well. How should we do it, right? So we agree that we should do it. How should we do it in a way that recognizes the humanity of the person who has done right and recognizing that the classroom is a space where we are all learning. So for me, then that student is less likely to feel attacked. And I also say, like, look, you're going to have emotions. Are you embarrassed? You might be, right? That's perfectly fine. But if the goal is that we want to be better and we want to be different and we want to not offend our classrooms and perpetuate harmful behaviors, then we are okay getting that feedback. So for me, in the context of the classroom, that for me is an important step in the process of just kind of articulating, these are my expectations.
Okay, so, well, I want to kind of take it out of the classroom. I know that you've given a lot of suggestions for the classroom, but what about in personal relationships? Because I think that's where people, you know, some of our listeners who are no longer in school, like, this is a concern. Mm-hmm. Like, well, how do I talk to my coworkers? How do I deal with people that I interact with who go to church with me? Like, how do we enter into conversation in those spaces?
You know, again, because I am focusing on white people's behaviors, you can bring me in to have a workshop because I can't tell you in kind of 1 second what to do. Like, that's where you, for the people who are in positions of power and have, because there are churches that also have folks come in and do, you know, provide some kind of professional development, right? So I can't kind of deliver an entire workshop in a soundbite. But just to recognize that one of the things that are really important for developing this skill is that it is a way to develop trust across racial lines, and it's a way to develop relationships across racial lines, and it is a skill, right? So I can't just deliver some kind of like what to do for kind of outside of the classroom, but you can, for folks who are part of organizations, like for colleagues, right, then bring in folks. So one of the things that I say, Dr. K, is that it's a skill. Right. One of the things that I do say to my students is that it is a skill. And just like any other skill, you have to practice it. Right. Right. Just like any other skill, you absolutely will probably mess up sometimes. But if you actually care about getting better at it, you will continue to put in the work.
Thank you, sir, so much. Dr. Bedelia Richards, the founder of Race Talk LLC and Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Richmond in Richmond, Virginia. Do you have a website where people can get in touch with you?
Absolutely. My website is www.racetalkllc.com. So that's RACETALKLLC.com. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Richards. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed our conversation.
Me too. So, folks, I just want to open it up to you. So why is it so difficult to talk about race? And what do you do? If you hear a racist comment, what exactly do you do? If there's somebody who gets under your skin by making a comment, like, what do you do? Jane Elliott and Justina might be able to find the clip of Jane Elliott who did the brown-eyed, blue-eyed test. Jane Elliott asked an audience full of white people if anybody in the audience wanted to trade places and become a black person. And she gave this whole argument that because no one stood up to trade places, it was an audience full of white people. It's because as a white person, Jane Elliott, who is white, makes the argument that you know that there is injustice, you know that things are not right, and you're either A, choosing not to do anything, or B, you are part of the problem with keeping that in place. It is a question that she says is one that white people have to wrestle with. Are you a part of the problem, or are you choosing not to see and challenge the problem? Why is it so difficult to talk about race? Where do you stand on this? How do you get into the conversation? We have the clip from Jane Elliott, and then we'll go to Bud from Baltimore. Hold tight, Bud. Let's listen to this clip.
It is National Brotherhood Week. What's brotherhood? Treat everyone as though he was your brother. And is there anyone in this United States that we do not treat as our brothers?
Yes.
Who?
The black people.
Who else?
Indians.
Absolutely, the Indians. Many places in the United States. How are black people treated? How are Indians treated? How are people who are of a different color than we are treated?
They don't get anything in this world.
Why is that?
Because they're a different color.
You think you know how that would feel to be judged by the color of your skin? Do you think you do? No, I don't think you would know how that felt unless you had been through it, would you? It might be interesting to judge people today by the color of their eyes. Would you like to try this?
Yeah!
Sounds like fun, doesn't it? Since I'm the teacher and I have blue eyes, I think maybe the blue-eyed people should be on top the first day. I mean, the blue-eyed people are the better people in this room.
Uh-oh.
Oh, yes, they are.
Yeah.
Blue-eyed people are smarter than brown-eyed people. This is a fact. The brown-eyed people do not get to use the drinking fountain. You'll have to use the paper cups. You brown-eyed people are not to play with the blue-eyed people on the playground. Well, the brown-eyed people in this room today are going to wear collars so that we can tell from a distance what color your eyes are. Ready, Laurie?
Brown-eyed.
She's a brown-eyed. You'll begin to notice today that we spend a great deal of time waiting for brown-eyed.
So that was Jane Elliott doing an experiment with her children. This experiment is probably about 20 years old now. It's brown-eyed, blue-eyed. And what she found the next day when she began to treat students differently because of the color of their eyes. She treated the blue-eyed children better than the brown-eyed children. And what she found by the middle of the day, even the blue eyes begin to think they were better than the brown eyes. And the brown eyes begin to think they were less than the blue eyes. In just one morning, that the treatment that we get in society that makes us feel like we are inferior is something that begins early on. And it's subtle. In that case, it was just the color of your eyes, something random. But think about it. When we have racism, what's racism based upon? Something random, the color of your skin. And we've built a whole society. We've built laws, policies, practices, procedures all around the color of your skin. That's what must be unpacked. We have Bud on the phone from Baltimore. Bud, how are you?
And I'm going to take my time and say this. I heard your whole show, but the only thing that stood out when you said that you need a platform with strength and fortitude. I don't know who you was talking about, but I thought about you. And I just really think, and I say this with a heavy heart, I think y'all need to take this downtime.
This what?
Like, your whole show. You, Aunt, and all y'all, I think y'all need to rough off.
Okay. Thank you very much, Bud. The fact that thank you very much, Bud. The fact that you sat on hold all this time just to tell me you didn't like my show, I appreciate you for doing that. I don't know what's going on here. But we're talking about why is it so difficult to talk about race? What is it that we must do to get into that conversation? And so I invite you to give us a call at 410-319-8888. I don't even know if people even care to talk about race anymore. I don't. I'm not sure whether or not people are as concerned about race, are as concerned about race as they used to be. It used to be part of our subject. So now let me go back. It turns out that maybe, and I'm willing to say this on the air, I think I might have misunderstood him. Because I thought I was hearing one thing. Apparently, he was saying something else. He was actually complimenting the show because I heard him saying, "You got to take this down." As soon as I heard "take it down," that was enough for me. But apparently, I'm wrong. So let me just say, Bud, thank you so much for staying on. We were sending you love, my man, because I truly heard something different. I should have played it all the way out. 410-319-8888. Why is it so hard to talk about race? One of the things is that they said that when you even have this conversation, that on the micro level, it should begin in separate groups. That first you need to have, according to this article I'm reading from the Atlantic, that says, you know, if you're having these conversations about race, you need to separate people first. You need to figure out how you can have this open conversation. You know, what we talk about when we talk about race. So we deal with the micro level of race, and then we begin to deal with the macro level. But micro is that you need to have people who are not of color talking to other people who are not of color about the importance of talking about race. And then we come together so that we can have a good entry point. According to the Brookings Institute, if you look at communities that are economically challenged, it is also very difficult in those particular cities to try to address the racial disparities. It's very difficult, they said, in Atlanta, for example. Atlanta has the worst income inequality among major U.S. cities. The richest households in Atlanta make 20 times more than the poorest households. In situations like that, talking about race is not only challenging, it actually is hard to move through because race gets caught up with class. When we come back, we got Michael and Kim standing by, and we'll take your calls when we return. Where there are school systems that are allowing parents to opt out of their child learning about anything about race, systemic racism, critical race theory. There are documents. You fill out the form. You want your child not to learn anything about the true racial history of this country. That's why it's so difficult. We have Michael on the phone. Michael's a new caller from Maryland. Then we'll go to Kim and then Jamila. Michael, how are you?
I'm doing very well. And yourself?
I'm doing well. Thanks for calling.
Yes, my thing is, I only caught the tail end of when you were speaking about when the teacher used the race thing as far as dealing with the color of the eyes.
Yes.
But if we realize and think about everything in whole and in general, we all extend from one family. So if I should extend from one family, we all should be one and equally. But being as though one race feel like it's more superior than the other, but we're not. Say, hypothetically, a black male and a white male can have the same qualifications for the same type of job. Who's going to get hired first? It's going to be the white male, because that is the way the country, people have set up things for it to run or for it to be when it shouldn't be. If we both had the same qualifications, you should pick the better one of all, not because of his skin color, not because of what he do. because we do the same thing, they have the same frame and type of mind, and doing the same type of work.
Right. I agree with you. But the problem that makes it so difficult when you're trying to do that is that everyone does not see each other on the same level, though.
But it shouldn't be that way, because if we all, as they say in the Constitution, we're all created equal.
Right.
Where at? If we still have the line of racism in the process.
Well, so that's no what we're talking about. It's one thing to believe that. It's another thing to watch it play out, and it's not playing out very well. Thank you so much, Michael. I appreciate you. We have Kim on the line. Kim, how are you?
Hi, Dr. K.
How you doing?
I've been talking about race for many, many years simply because I entered a professional environment where it was predominantly white, and I could not ignore what was going on, and for years and years and years. So it's always been a topic for me. And today, I tell you now, I'm at a client's house in Carroll County, and she was speaking of the influx of, immigrants invading America. And I said, the world is a circle. I said, people left Europe, they left Africa, they left all over the world, and they inhabited other people's country or invaded other people's country. So I said, because of global warming, people are going to have to migrate, from South Pacific and stuff. They don't have food. The ecosystem is all messed up. So I said, migration has been a part of the world.
Right.
And when people are starving, they're not following any rules that you say they should come in under. I said, and migration has been part of the world. So let's tell the truth. I had that conversation today, I kid you not. And I'm always talking to my clients about race. If they start talking about people of color or why your people this and why your people that, we're going to talk about this. And I never backed away from it. I'm like, somebody got an enlightenment. You all been brainwashed just like we had. You all been thinking those people are bad people. And so we're constantly having to fight stereotypes. And so I clearly have but several clients in my race conversations, and I tell them my truth. And because they were taught to be superior, they live in a bubble of feeling that all the problems are in the city, all the problems are with minorities. And you point the finger, those people, and that's how you were taught. However, you've never even met these people. My clients will watch TV when they see a person of color. Oh, I wish they'd get them off of. I say, were you taught that?
Right.
I say, you were taught to not like that man. He has a suit on. He has a job. What is his name? I said, that's the mayor of Baltimore. You don't like him because you were taught to see people in one light. And I straight up tell him, Dr.
Wow. Thank you so much, Kim. I appreciate you. I have Jamila and then Ankh and then Thomas. Jamila, how are you?
How are you, Dr. K?
I'm doing well, thank you.
I'm happy to make an announcement first and foremost. I heard the brother say in regards to taking it downtown. He said y'all should have a placement valued right there in the middle of City Hall, with this radio talk show. Now, what I'd like to say is this. Being though we are all in the face mask, right?
Yes.
For the most part of those who's willing to have it on, we all should be rebirthing ourselves, And for anybody that still have that kind of in their heart, their mind, their spectrum of superiority, they need to come back down to being an infant all over again. Mm. And let's figure out whether or not if we can just tune into and fill in with the energies that is more positive than negative of what we call superiority. Because white supremacy is not superiority. And black people or Native Americans, they do have a superiority because we pay attention to what's going on around us. If there's a narrow-mindedness and a blinder on a person that don't get the point about understanding that the palm of your hand is cream, and the back of your hand is brown chocolate or beige.
Right. I don't think people get that. I do get your point, and I don't think people get that. And I also want to say thank you so much to Jamila for pointing out. No, I was saying thank you for pointing out what Buddy said. I completely misunderstood him. So thank you for just kind of giving us some clarity in that sense, too. I don't think people understand that this whole race thing is on the surface. I don't. And I like what Jamila was saying in terms of just trying to help make that point for people. We have Unc and then we have Thomas. Unc, how are you? Unc, are you with us or is that Thomas?
Oh, hi. How are you?
Hey, this is Thomas?
Yeah, this is Tom.
Hey.
How you doing?
I'm doing well.
Yeah, it's uncomfortable for me, you know, in the workplace. It's like we are trained not to, practice racism, or, treat anybody different because of their preference as far as, it's very uncomfortable, and you want to assume that your coworkers are not racist. Right. However, when they say something out of the way, I ignore it because I don't want to get into it. And I think it's not popular to be a racist. Do you think it's popular, Dr.
No, I don't think it's popular at all. I actually think it's very difficult now in certain places. Like, can we agree that there are some places it seems like the behavior is completely supported?
Oh, sure.
And then there's some places. I mean, I'm thinking Maryland. I would think at least in certain parts of Maryland, it would be very difficult to openly be racist. We know there are some parts of Maryland where you can drive around and you can see Trump flags, you can see Confederate flags. Like there are parts of Maryland like that as well. But I don't think it's a popular opinion to be openly racist, no.
Oh, of course not. Nobody, because it's quite frankly, it's embarrassing. So I think looking at it from that standpoint, we are better than what we used to be. Mm-hmm. However, we have a long way to go.
So now, how do we get there, though? In your opinion, how do we get there?
Well, I mean, we start some kind of dialogue about racism with folks who are, white or some kind of other nationality. That's the only thing I could think of. However, I'm not going to, if I had a problem with somebody of a different race, I wouldn't openly say it. But, of course, when I'm sitting around a dinner table with my family, I might say a couple of things here and there, but I think that's kind of normal.
Okay. I appreciate you laying that on the table, Thomas. Thomas is right. I don't think it's popular in certain environments to be openly racist. We understand that there are certain environments, certain places in this country where it is okay. Oh, on Facebook Live, Ray Davis said, our insatiable need for whites to seek racial empathy for us or discuss race with whites is psychologically damaging to us as black people. It consciously immediately places us at their feet, asking them to purge their white privilege. He goes on, just note that our conversation about race should be among us alone behind closed doors in a war room. Our racial discussion should be about rebuilding black family infrastructure, rebuilding our immune system, recycling our dollars, career education for our children. If we did that for two generations, he said they would come knocking on our door. We have Unc on the phone. Unc, how are you?
Yeah, I'm still vertical. How are you, sister?
I'm still vertical as well.
Yeah. They still want you to remember the Alamo, right?
Yeah, they do.
Right?
Everybody wants you. The Alamo, we remember everything that happened in this country. They just don't want to talk about
slavery. Yeah. They want you to remember 9/11 every year, right?
Every single year.
Yeah, that's history. Listen, do you know who John Edgar Howard is?
No. Can you tell me who John Edgar Howard. I am not hearing too well on my headphones today, so I'm missing a lot. Like with Buddy, I'm missing things. So can you tell me who that person is? Did you say John or James?
It's John Edgar Howard. He's one of the founders of Maryland. Now, they want to take black history out of the classroom. Right today, my grandbaby is studying about John Edgar Howard. And every time you come on, Dr. K, you should announce a black statement. A history statement.
Okay. Yeah. I appreciate that. We will definitely take that into account.
Right.
All right. So John Edgar Howard, who Unc was mentioning, who was a soldier and a politician from Maryland, he was governor of the state in 1788, and he served 3 1-year terms. He was also elected to the Continental Congress, the Congress of the United States, and the U.S. Senate. He actually ran for president in the 1816 presidential election. That's what he was talking about with John Edgar Howard. He is saying that when we start the show at some point, we really should look to give a Black history fact. John Edgar Howard is actually one of just a few men mentioned in Maryland, My Maryland, which, if I'm not mistaken, is no longer our state song, right? But Maryland, My Maryland mentions John Edgar Howard. And in fact, there are at least three streets in Baltimore that share his name. The street that's running John Street in the Bolton Hill area, the east-west running Eager Street, and the north-south running Howard Street. So he is well known. So it's interesting to think about it. I want to just share with you why I think America doesn't love children. I've said that. I said it at the beginning. I just want to kind of put that out there. I came across some statistics that I thought were fascinating to give you just some background about why America does not love its children. We don't prioritize our children. And here's why. The New York Times published an article yesterday that talked about how much governments spend on child care for toddlers. This is the annual public spending per child on early childhood. In Norway, they spend $29,000 on per child on early child care. Iceland spends $24,000, Finland $23,000, Denmark is $23,000, Germany spends $18,656, Sweden $18,000, Austria $12,000, Slovenia $12,000, New Zealand $10,000, Spain spends $9,000, Chile $8,000, Lithuania $8,000, Australia $8,000, Hungary $7,000, Israel $3,000. This is how much money is spent, public money, is spent per child on early childhood care. America spends $500. That's it. That is all we spend per child on early childhood care. We fall so far behind. In fact, Elizabeth Davis, who's an economist studying child care, said, we as a society with public funding spend so much less on children before kindergarten than once they reach kindergarten. And yet the science of child development shows how very important investment in the youngest ages are, and we get societal benefits from those investments. Think about Denmark. Now, we talked yesterday about how Jill Scott wants to move over to the net. She said she wants to get out of this country. I think she'll go to Holland. Okay, so all the way over there is part of all this is together. So 2-year-olds in Denmark attend childcare during the day where they are guaranteed a spot, and their parents pay no more than 25% of the cost. The guaranteed spot remains until the child is in after-school care up until the age of 10. If parents choose to stay home or hire a nanny, the government helps pay for that, too. 2-year-olds in the United States are less likely to attend formal child care. If they do, their parents pay full price, an average of $1,100 a month, and they compete to find a spot. If their parents stay home or find another arrangement, they are also on their own to finance it, as they will be until kindergarten. That here in this country, America does not give any money. $500 is no money. And that is how much we spend per child in this country on early childhood education. I think it's something that, as we start thinking about how we go forward, you can tell a lot about the country with the way they treat the least of them. We have had this conversation, or iterations of this conversation, before, where we have looked and we've thought about why it is that our children right now are so angry and so frustrated. I think it's because they have watched how we have not prioritized them over the last year. Think about it. In Baltimore City, just as an example, have you noticed, and Justina could get the direct facts, have you noticed how many more children are being shot these days? Have you noticed that? 16-year-olds and 14-year-olds, have you noticed that? Have you also noticed, I think is fascinating, more women are getting killed here in Baltimore City. That we've settled down with the 300-plus murders and the 700-plus shootings, non-fatal shootings. But is anyone else concerned that our children seem to be particularly upset and angry right now? There was a shooting that happened that started, they were arguing, it turned to a fight, and then shooting broke out. Like three people got shot. That wasn't in Baltimore City, but it involved children. There have been shootings at schools. I wonder if our children have recognized that we do not take them as being full-fledged members of our society. We take them as people that we can move around and we can make decisions for as if they are not full-fledged members of our society. And I'm not talking about a hand, arm baby. No, no, no. I'm talking about the children that end up on the street and they're doing shooting and killing. What does it mean that we live in a society where our children don't see us prioritize them? Justina got the number in terms of shootings. 14 children under the age of 18. That's the next generation for each of those families. I mean, children are the ones who carry our legacy forward. They carry our dreams forward. Our children right now are not being prioritized. And it's not just the ways in which we're looking at childcare. It's even the ways in which we're having debates over whether or not they should be vaccinated. There was a study that was done. They found that parents, a large percentage of parents, do not want to have an actual vaccination mandate, though they do plan to get their children vaccinated. They just don't want it mandated. We're making decisions. I mean, I stop and think that right now I'm just happy that I have 18-year-old children because I'm like, this is a really challenging time as a parent. It is challenging to think about how we go forward, particularly in a society now where parents can opt out of having their child learn anything about America's racial history. This document, I did find one document online, and it comes out of Ohio. It's an opt-out form. And you, as a parent, you go through and you say, I do not consent. This is for the entire state of Ohio. And you check which ones you want to take off. The 1619 Project, Revisionist History, Critical Race Theory, Culturally Responsive Teaching, Ethnic Studies, Action Civics, White Fragility, Anti-Racism, Systemic Racism, Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, Equity Initiatives, Brain Pop, Cassell, and any programs that deal with new mindsets, Unbound Education, Panorama, the Wallace Foundation. You don't want any teaching at all that involves directly teaching about America's complicated racial history. You don't want to do that. And so for the state of Ohio, as a parent, you can simply download the opt-out form, fill it out, and send it back in. And the school then has to respect that. So your child, I don't know if they're going to be taught in a different classroom, but I do believe is putting the shackles on parents who want their child to learn this history, because that means you're going to have separate education classes. How about teachers? How do teachers go forward in this environment? So if I'm a teacher, and I'm talking about K-12, now, I don't do complicated critical race theory or culturally responsive, you know, high-level instruction with a kindergartner. But I do use culturally responsive teaching strategies to make sure that the classroom brings in to the context of diverse perspectives. I do make sure that if I am decorating my room, that I want my room to reflect all the children, not all the children just in my classroom, but the number of races and ethnicities that are reflected in this country. Like, even if I'm teaching a classroom full of white students, it is incumbent upon me as the teacher to bring in other voices, to talk about who is missing, to talk about what else is happening. Like, that is part of my job. And now, if you have students who, because of their parents, are now opted out of this kind of learning, opted out of talking about the complicated racial history of America. Are you, in a sense, raising up the next generation of racists? Well, let me tell you why I said that. Now, I'd love to hear from you, 410-319-8888. If young people, during the time when they are most open to the learning, when they can be most challenged, when brain development is still happening, if they are not learning early on about what it means to be Black, what it means to be white or Latinx, or what it means to be indigenous in this country, if they're not learning early on that history was not just made by George Washington, but also by George Washington Carver, if they're not learning early on that you can read about, you know, Ralph Waldo Emerson and his poetry while also learning about Langston Hughes, you can talk about Susan B. Anthony, but you can also get into Sojourner Truth and her activist work. That if they are not learning that, if they're not learning about why it is that people were willing to die during the Civil Rights Movement, because remember, part of that was that you had to be willing to die. You might walk out and join a march, and you may not show up back at home. Why is it that people are willing to challenge Jim Crow that didn't just start with the first for colored only sign? In order to understand that, you really have to teach these issues. You have to teach about the truth of this country. And I am greatly disturbed by this, because where does it end? It's starting here in Ohio. And you got to look at these countries. I mean, look at these states and know, starting in Ohio, and you know where it's going. You know it's going to Florida. You know it's going to Texas. You know it's going to Tennessee. So you're going to have what I've been predicting all along, two different societies. There's going to be one where you're not going to have any rights as a woman. I mean, think about what's happening in Texas. And I'm very grateful that they put a block on that. I mean, that is something we have to know, that they, because Joe Biden's administration, because they're suing right now, what's happening in Texas, there is a block on that law. That ban has been blocked. It's not blocked indefinitely, but there is more time to organize. But if you have states that say women don't have any rights around whether or not they're going to terminate their pregnancy, and I know that gets people moving to terminate their pregnancy. How about just they have body autonomy? You also now have the pulling out of the educational system, all of the complicated history that talks about why we see ourselves the way we do, why we struggle the way we do, why we have a type of tension the way that we have it. If you take that out, then my question is, what is school for? It's going to go back to what it used to be. I think many of us who are of a certain age can remember whitewashed history, where you only learned about a certain person's history, a certain race's history, and only from that perspective. You learned George Washington's story, but didn't talk about the people that he enslaved. Didn't talk about the indigenous people that he, because of his choice to give them, you know, blankets that were infected with measles, the impact of that on their community. If we don't talk about Black genocide, if we don't talk about Black Wall Street, if we don't talk about even Dr. King is what they want to pull up. They don't even want them talking about Dr. King. They don't want anything in the curriculum that connects to anyone other than the majority. And do understand, by 2040, the majority won't be the majority anymore. You're setting up a system that is designed to fail all of us and stop the progress of this country moving forward. And that is why I think education, as I kept saying, education is really that last and final frontier that's going to determine how we go forward. It is what's happening in the classroom. And I said that there are at least three. I know definitely two, maybe a third battleground in this country. And one is the classroom. The second one, of course, is the voting booth, the ballot box. And the third one is our churches. When we talk about changing this country, we got to talk about moving into those particular spaces and making the change, because it's not going to be easy. It's going to be something that is very difficult. I mentioned Atlanta a little while ago about how Atlanta is just a great example of why it's so hard to have the race conversation because of what's happening with Atlanta's economic structure, that the richest households make nearly 20 times more than the poorest households. That's according to the Brookings Institute, that a child raised in the bottom quintile has a 4% chance of raising to the top quintile in Atlanta. How do you have a conversation around race when you live in a city where there are black folks who make 20 times more than other black folks? And like, race is not the issue. Nobody wants to discuss race in this context. And then people don't understand why it matters that when a place like Atlanta got rid of all their public housing, what they ended up doing is pricing folks out of it. They could not afford to live there. Hey, folks, let's pick up tomorrow. Let's make sure that we have a conversation at 2 p.m. that matters, and that we look forward, hopefully, to Buddy calling us back tomorrow. Buddy, let's pick up our conversation tomorrow. We'll start on an even keel and have that conversation. Teddy P., thanks for chiming in. So glad you finally found us. This is Today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. K. Wise Whitehead. I look forward to having the conversation tomorrow. Keep it here for Two-Way Talk with Anthony McCarthy and Kara Williams. And then the Morgan News Hour comes on at 6, and then we have Slow Jams being played at 7 p.m. Stay with us. 7 p.m. Stay with us. 7 p.m. Stay with us.